The Guardian.
Welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly, where today we will look back at England-Holland in Euro 96, the greatest football match in the history of time, run by Teddy Sheringham, in the company of Simon Burton and Jacob Steinberg. Archie Rintoul will join us from Germany. Sid Lowe will join us from Spain as well. Barry is over in his house. How are you, Baz?
I'm very well in my house, thank you. I've got a nice bottle of, is it Isla or Isla Negra? Mm-hmm. Cabernet Sauvignon from Chile, which I'm enjoying at the moment.
How far through it are you?
Not too far into it, don't worry.
You're not slurring yet. You're not repeating stories about your charity work, etc., etc. Hey, how was the most miserable day of your life?
It was fine, actually. I had a few drinks. I watched a Moore Stubber Bill. I did a bit of housework, a few chores around the house. And I think... Yeah, it was absolutely grand. If that was... I have definitely had more miserable days in my life.
Yallop has said below the line, I am a Max Foshan fan, but as soon as this started, the Barry loving on the last part, it was clear to me that that last voice was going to be Jimbo. I don't need it to go back to the way it was, but that was a seriously sweet moment. Cheers to all involved. And Gavin said, I love Jimbo back on.
Sorry, I would like to echo the sentiment in case I didn't sound grateful enough. On Thursday, I would like to thank everyone who participated in what was for me a totally excruciating time, but I appreciate the noble intentions behind it, so thank you everyone.
This from Gavin saying, I loved Jimbo back on, it was a good nostalgia blast, would always want him to come back, but I like Max as well, shame it can't be a Piers Morgan, Ben Shepherd type thing. If you were going to cast me and Jimbo in... Piers Morgan, Ben Shepherd. Who would be Piers and who would be Ben?
Well, I would refuse to go on the pod with whoever is Piers. So, you know, I'm really not buying into this.
So that's that then.
Reinvention of Piers Morgan. You know, let's not forget the many atrocities that man has committed in the name of self-promotion.
Yeah, anyway, let's crack on with the pod. We've got lots to get through, and it'll begin with England 4, Holland 1 from Euro 96. Welcome to part 2 of the Guardian Football Weekly, where we will look back at England 4, Holland 1 on the 18th of June 1996. The final group game, a draw was enough to see both sides go through. But two goals from Alan Shearer, two from Teddy Sheringham put them 4-0 up, with Patrick Kluivert's goal enough to put Holland through instead of Scotland. According to some papers, it sparked a national party. Let's do this in the company of Jacob Steinberg and Simon Burton. First time we've had either of them on the pod since lockdown began. Jacob, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, really good. How's lockdown been for you?
I've got a one-year-old son. So let's leave it at that.
Fair enough. And Simon, the first person who's been asked while we do these pods in our own houses to do it underneath a duvet. So we should take a photo to put it out. How are you, Simon? And when was the last time you put a duvet on your head like this?
I haven't done this before. I was listening to one of the Guardian's other podcasts recently where they got a guest to hide under a duvet. And so I was wondering if this was going to be necessary and kind of looking forward to it. So I'm quite pleased with how it's worked out.
Wow, you look lovely. And has lockdown been okay for you?
It's been intense. I've got a 12-year-old daughter and I'd take the one-year-old son, thank you.
The one-year-old son has learned how to climb upstairs during lockdown. So
right. Yeah. Well, I've been climbing up the walls, so...
I don't know if the transfer window is open for such a swap deal. And, you know,
I don't know. Let's ask the government.
Memories of the game. Now, Jacob, you were at the game as a nine-year-old. I mean, that must have been extraordinary.
Yeah, it was great. It was the first ever England game I'd been to, first ever tournament game I'd been to. It was an amazing experience. I can't really remember anything from the game itself, apart from the old Wembley being really, really big and it being quite hard to see anything because there was the running track in that stadium. It was for the Greyhounds, wasn't it? So I don't remember much beyond trying to see what was going on. and it was quite interesting to watch it back just now and sort of see perhaps it wasn't the amazing England performance we thought.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, as a 9-year-old, I'm just trying to think, you know, when I first went to football at 6 and 7, I couldn't really do 90 minutes. But I reckon at about 9, you've almost got it in you to last the whole game, haven't you?
Oh, yeah. A massive know-it-all and everything. You're telling everybody around you what's going on, pointing out the tactical intricacies of the game. Very annoying.
So nothing much has changed, really. Sorry, I couldn't miss that one.
That teed you up.
Simon, how old were you and where were you when this was played?
So I was 21 and watching with friends and a friend's brother in a flat somewhere. And yeah, I don't know. I went to a couple of games in this tournament. Scotland-Holland, which was 0-0, and France-Czech Republic semi-final, which was 0-0. So I didn't do very well. But yeah, great memories of this one.
Yeah, I was at the England-Scotland game. That a mate of mine from school charged me double the price of the ticket that he'd paid for it. But I think it was only a tenner or maybe 20 quid right in the front row behind with restricted view behind Seaman's goal when he saved that penalty from Gary McAllister. And this game I watched in my living room with about 15 mates and my dad on an armchair telling everyone to be quiet. And I just remember this is peak football for me. It's sort of one of my favourite games of all time. And I was nervous about watching it back because you were never going to recreate that moment because we know what happens. Barry, I presume you did watch it, but you can't remember where or anything
I'm
about
I'm fairly sure. I mean, happened. I was 23 years old, and this would have been one of the happiest times of my life. My home county of Offaly were pretty good at hurling. I was in my drinking pomp. I had a job I loved at Hot Press magazine, sort of my first proper job. I had my first proper girlfriend who would later go on to break my heart. So I was on top of the world during this summer. So just what I needed to bring me down to earth with a resounding thump was an emphatic England win over Holland. I'm pretty sure, because I remember watching all the other England games, I would have watched this in the International Bar on Wicklow Street in Dublin, which was near the Hot Press offices where I worked. And I would have been in the company of probably 40 or 50 like-minded individuals who would all have been vociferously rooting for the Dutch in this game.
Rob Smythe wrote a piece in The Guardian a few years ago, an On Second Thoughts article sort of reappraising this game. And I suppose the first question is this as good a performance as, I guess, the last 20-odd years, 24 years, have brought it into our minds, Simon?
I think that all things considered, it was. Firstly, we stuffed the Dutch 4-1. Right, you don't really have to go beyond that. That is a great England performance. Although, you know, we didn't overwhelm them at any point with the quality of our play. We beat the Dutch 4-1.
It's that simple.
I really think it is. I think that there are, so Holland were a really great national team at the time. They'd at the World Cup in 94, they'd just narrowly lost to Brazil in the quarterfinals. At the following World Cup, they narrowly lost to Brazil in the semifinals. They were a team that got to semifinals of most tournaments that they played in. Ajax had won the Champions League the year before. They were full of stars and gods and geniuses and also a few hangers-on. They'd also done something to us in the qualifying for the 94 World Cup that I think damaged our psyche in some way. And this was revenge for that. And, you know, there was a lot of history here.
Yeah, that's true. I hadn't put the two and two together tonight watching the game. But obviously there's so much about Koeman pulling back. Was it Platt in 93? And
yeah,
that must have meant something. Platt is on the pitch at the end. That must have meant so much to that England team.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there were times. So England did put the Dutch off their game. The Dutch, so Bokamp was on his own in attack and didn't, he lacked people to flick the ball onto and to bring into play until Kluivert came on late in the game. Vinter, you tried to support him a bit from midfield, but he wasn't really getting that. For a lot of the game, you know, Gus Hiddink, the Dutch manager, he could have been turning to his assistant and saying, you know, can we not knock it? And given where we'd been, that's a pleasure.
Jacob, I was at this time completely obsessed with Teddy Sheringham. And so it's impossible for me to watch a game where he's playing and not be completely biased to his every touch and just think that he is completely dictating the game. But watching this back today, I felt that Teddy Sheringham was completely dictating the game. You know, I think what's interesting about watching these old games back is you have affinities with players. And so just whenever he controlled the ball, or whenever he just played a side foot pass or did a dummy that was completely unnecessary, it just made me so happy. So I'm looking for an objective viewpoint, either from current Jacob or precocious nine-year-old know-it-all Jacob, as to whether Sheringham was that influential in this football match.
Precocious nine-year-old, I have no idea what I would have thought at the time, but watching that, I thought there were some really nice touches from him, some very clever passes, through, especially in the first half. And I think he came into that game under quite a lot of pressure because England hadn't been that convincing in either of the first two games against Switzerland. Obviously, it was the 1-1. I think that was the opening game of the tournament. And Shearer had scored quite early on, and then gradually England, as often the way in tournament games, had kind of lost their way and given away that late penalty, and obviously went into the Scotland game under a lot of pressure because of the draw with the Swiss. And even in the Scotland game, the first half was pretty poor. It's kind of forgotten how bad Gascoigne is in that game against Scotland before his amazing volley. And Sheringham hadn't scored in either of those games. Obviously, Shearer had scored both goals, and he went into a bit of pressure under the against Holland. There was obviously Fowler was on the bench, who scored 30, 35 goals for Liverpool that season. I think obviously Les Ferdinand was the player of the year for Newcastle, having almost just won the league. So Sheringham was there were question marks about that. And there were question marks you could even hear in some of the ITV commentary that we just saw from Brian Moore and Kevin Keegan. So for him to play well, both in the first half, I think he almost scored in the first half as well, and then to score that really nice header as well. I think that was probably the first time that anybody had probably spoken with a bit of conviction about that understanding between Shearer and Sheringham, with, you know, the one dropping off and the other one, Shearer, being that old-fashioned target man.
And there are better passes in the history of football, Barry. I mean, we saw Kaká through ball for AC Milan in the 2005 Champions League final the other week. But Sheringham's pass to Shearer for the third goal, where he just opens his body after Gazza's made that run, is probably my favourite pass in the history of football. And it is that goal is the sort of standout moment of this game.
Well, I would argue there is a better pass in this game, where Bergkamp hooks a ball around the corner to Kluivert for the Dutch goal. But yeah, it was Teddy Sheringham played very well in this game. I'm a big fan of his. He talked, I think it was the Telegraph, maybe, through the goal in the last week or two, and he said that the ball came to him, he could have shot, he reckoned he had a, I don't know, 60% chance of scoring, but if he passed to Shearer, he knew that Shearer had an 80% chance of scoring. So he played the percentages and laid it on a plate to Shearer, who buried it. So yeah, brilliant. I think you might be slightly over-egging the pass pudding there, Max. It wasn't that brilliant.
It's an insight into his mind, how his mind works, slightly like Ziggy from Quantum Leap, that he's constantly working out percentages as a game is going.
Well, he just sees a green matrix of numbers. He's, you know, a cross between The Matrix and Terminator.
I've been listening to people tell me that's one of the great passes for a long time now. I think it's incredibly overrated. I think mostly it was underhit, right? It was just too slow. He didn't get the weight on it. It gave the keeper a chance to close Shearer down. And Shearer's finish is spectacular. It's fantastic, right just inside the post. But it had to be, because Sheringham's pass was no good.
Do you think so? I think Shearer might slice this a little bit.
I think that he had only one place to put it. Otherwise, he was missing that. You know, Sheringham may have thought it's 60% that I score and 100% for Shearer. But by the time the ball arrives at Shearer, I think he's at maybe 40, 45%. So I think Shearer made Sheringham's pass, Sheringham's dodgy pass.
You're 35 to 40% out from Teddy Sheringham on the percentage chances of Alan Shearer scoring that goal. Jacob, we talked about with Michael Butler about Blackburn winning the league and the sort of the beauty in Alan Shearer. And I guess it's compared a bit to an Erling Braut Haaland now, the simplicity of a centre-forward like Shearer. And the way he takes that third goal and the way he slams home a penalty as well, it's sort of the ultimate no-nonsense, isn't it?
Yeah, if Shearer could have taken every penalty in the shootout against Germany, then I fancy they might have ended up going through. The way he struck that first penalty against Holland, even though Van der Sar goes the right way, there's no chance that he's getting there. Similarly for that third goal, I think that on the third goal, it's probably that moment where you've got Gascoigne bustling through, Sheringham with the presence of mind to tee up Shearer for that chance. I think that's probably why people have such amazing memories of that game, because it was that maybe in that one moment where England were kind of playing the Dutch at their own game, you know, the total football kind of style. It's amazing play from England. And I think that it's probably not something that's in keeping with the entire performance. And it's that moment. Without that moment, it's probably not going to be held up in the same way, that game. I'm not sure if others agree. But
well, can I play devil's advocate here, right? You're playing the Dutch. They've got Jordi Cruyff on one wing, Peter Hoekstra on the other. I mean, this was his fifth and final game for the Netherlands. Clarence Seedorf was out of position. Dennis Bergkamp was out of position. Edgar Davids had been sent home. Mark Overmars was absent, I think, through injury. You got lucky.
I think that they could have been 11 cardboard cutouts in orange shirts, and it would have made very little difference how the game's remembered. You know, that a goal celebration is a buzz, right? And then three of them against Holland in the space of 11, 12 minutes. By the time the fourth goal goes in, every England fan, every sentient English being watching that game is drunk on pure adrenal joy.
It's so true, because you forget as well that, you know, tournament football there are so few games, but, you know, in this tournament, to do that in one game, Barry, devil's advocate, is extraordinary. And I suppose, in a way, I don't know if this sounds ridiculous, but because the goals happen so quickly, the second, third and fourth, it's almost hard to build a performance during the game, because all you're doing is scoring goals, right? You don't have time to sort of conjure and create a beautiful performance because you're just scoring goals.
Well, I mean, just to go back to what Simon said there about all the England fans being drunk on adrenal joy, and then to absolutely put the cherry on the cake, the Dutch score a goal which puts out Scotland, you know, which just sends you over the edge on adrenal drunkenness.
I don't know if that's true, but I think, Jacob and Simon, you can disagree with me. I think most England fans, that rival with Scotland is one of those big team, small team rivalries. I'm really upset Scottish fans now that they hate us. But actually, I kind of wanted the Scots to progress. I remember in the England-Scotland game at Wembley, just how brilliant the Scotland fans were. And, you know, it was 0-0 at half-time, wasn't it? And Rocking All Over the World by Status Quo came on, and every Scotland fan was doing the guitars to Status Quo, and all England fans were just sort of standing there looking at them going, I wish we didn't have all these inhibitions, and I wish we could be like that. I wish we could be as happy as them, but we can't because we're drawing 0-0 with Scotland. So, well, I certainly wanted Scotland to progress, so that goal didn't... I found it funny, but I didn't feel adrenal, drunken joy when Kluivert put Scotland out.
What I would say about that is, at the end of the game, right, we've just absolutely kind of destroyed Holland. They've lost 4-1. At the end of it, they're fine, right? They're through to a quarterfinal against France. We're through to a quarterfinal against Spain. It's no big deal, right? If the Dutch had not scored, that one goal, or if Scotland had scored a second against the Swiss at Villa Park, then the Dutch would have been on the floor weeping at the end of that game. And that would have made... I really like Dutch people. I'm a big fan of Dutch football.
Some of your best friends are Dutch, right?
I just like seeing teams I support make other teams weep. I like that. And that's what we're missing at the end of this game.
You made a point, Jacob, when we were watching Paul Gascoigne about his physique and how you just wouldn't have a player who looked like that anymore.
Yeah, I think it's mentioned in the commentary as well by Kevin Keegan at some point. And he said it's maybe 80 minutes into the game where he starts saying, you know, people are questioning his fitness, but he's still going. And yeah, he was probably, this is probably one of his better performances in the tournament. I do sometimes think about that chance against Germany where he's stretching to meet it. And I think it's in extra time. It would have been the golden goal, would have sent England through to the final, which they probably would have won. And you just think, would a fitter player have got there? Would someone quicker have got there? If you were to magically put Cristiano Ronaldo in that position, that's probably being bundled into the net, into the top corner. I just think you look at him and he just looks a little bit out of shape. And I think that came across in the Scotland game, where he could barely do anything right in the first half. I remember watching that game back a couple of years ago, and it's really surprising how poor he is in that game. And I didn't even think in this game that it's a particularly special performance from him, or indeed England. I don't think it was a scintillating display where they've blown Holland away for 90 minutes. It's really that 10-15 minute spell where all those goals suddenly go in at once. At the same time, they don't really give away many chances. The best chance that Holland do have is the Bergkamp one, where Southgate comes up with a bad back header, and that's not down to any amazing Dutch play on by the same token. That's just a mistake from England.
Yeah, well, I mean, Aaron Winter missed a couple of decent chances. Bergkamp missed a couple. And obviously, Gascoigne and the England team in general, their immediate pre-tournament preparation wasn't ideal. This was, you know, the time of the dentist chair. And I think, am I correct in thinking there was talk that some people actually wanted Gascoigne chucked out of the squad because of the hijinks on the plane back from Hong Kong? Because apparently, you know, he completely trashed the plane. And as far as I know, there was talk that, you know, he had incurred a lot of public wrath. So if England had bombed out of this tournament in the group stages, he very much would have been the scapegoat.
There are two things. One, that goal against Scotland is just unbelievably brilliant. And two, I thought his performance in this game is really quite disciplined. And it's not the Gazza that you see on, you know, YouTube highlights reels. You know, he's not driving through because maybe he couldn't do that anymore. But he actually defensively plays quite well, I think, Simon.
I agree. You know, there are lots of important tackles as well as important passes. There's one beautiful pass to McManaman, who's down the left, in the middle of the second half, that I particularly kind of stood out. A beautiful curling pass that put McManaman up against Bergkamp, who's popping up at the right back position and ends up getting booked for fouling McManaman. So there were passes, there were moments when Gascoigne picks up the ball from Seaman and is kind of knotting play together in a more withdrawn role, and also quite a lot of tackling. I think it was a pretty strong midfield performance all round. Now, famously against Scotland, they were about to sub him when he scored. So when the penalty was awarded, the England bench is getting ready to make a change. And had the penalty gone in, Gascoigne would then have left the field. But the penalty didn't go in. They left things for a while, and he scores 90 seconds later. So on those moments, you know, history often rests. And I do think, obviously, the whole dentist chair thing in the build-up to the tournament was embarrassing, but it did create an us-against-the-world mentality among the squad, of the sort that Jose Mourinho has worked so terribly hard to manufacture. But I think it brought the squad together a lot. And although it was, you know, it appeared terribly ill-disciplined, I think that it had a useful role in the end.
Because they were getting a lot of grief from the media, and after this game, Alan Shearer made some, you know, came out and sort of made the point that we've shown them, our critics in the press, which I suppose he was totally entitled to do. But I find it interesting that that's the young Alan Shearer. The Alan Shearer now would probably talk disapprovingly about, you know, if players got up to similar antics in his role as a pundit. But I can see the point of view of both Shearers, I suppose.
I think it was perhaps Martin Samuel in the Daily Mail recently who was writing about all of this, and he said that he was if it was him, that he was one of the journalists who was actually in the bar or in a bar when they saw the England players out in Hong Kong. It might not have been the dentist chair night, but out in Hong Kong, drinking quite a lot and everything. And they didn't actually, I think that the sports journalists kind of chose not to write it and everything, but it appears in the end on the front of the papers, and they fly back to England, and by the time they get back, it's the news desks are ringing them and everything and asking for them to get into this now. At that point, obviously, they have to start writing. When it comes to the press conference and they have to ask Venables about this, Venables completely stood by the team and hammers the media for it. And he was saying in this piece that this was one of the things that created this big togetherness in the side, that the manager, even though he knew that the team was wrong, didn't go for them.
Simon, you were making a point about Venables and his relationship with the Dutch and his love of Dutch football and how, you know, this was such a huge game for him.
Yeah, I think that when one of the points he made to the squad when he took over 2 years earlier was to talk about Holland as the kind of end goal of what he wanted to do. Obviously, he was taking over from Graham Taylor, who played a more direct kind of football, Carlton Palmer in midfield, famously. And he wanted to take the England team in a very different direction and knew it would be a process. And he was always looking to the 1998 World Cup as the end goal. Obviously, in the end, he wasn't allowed to take the team there. But Holland were his kind of icon when he took over the team. And that's what he wanted to turn them into, a team that was their equal. And then the moment the draw was made, he was immediately working on a tactical plan for this match. And if you read any of the autobiographies of the players who were involved or talk to them, they all talk about the specific match training for this match. And Venables in his autobiography says that this performance was 18 months in the making of planning and training specific for this game, which I suppose you can only do for a group game. Now, that's the only match that you have months to prepare for. But so in particular, he pushed McManaman a lot further forward, tried to play more with a three in attack with Sheringham and McManaman off Shearer, and to pin back the Dutch, to stop the Dutch attacking down the wings. And certainly, McManaman's on the right for most of the game, and all of their attacking, their width in the first half in particular, is from Cruyff on the other side. McManaman totally, and I suppose Neville behind him, totally keeps them quiet down the English right wing.
It's interesting, you mentioned Venables, who didn't obviously manage England after this. It was January of this year that he announced he'd be standing down as England coach after Euro 96 because of court cases due to be heard later in the year, which he felt would interfere with the national side's efforts to qualify for the 98 World Cup. As it transpired, he became director of football at Portsmouth in July 96, having conducted a review of his legal commitments and discovered they'd not be as heavy as initially anticipated. In 1998, he was disqualified as a company director for 7 years. It's hard to know, isn't it? I mean, England had, you know, if it had been better if Venables had taken England to 98, or you know, Hoddle did a pretty good job there, didn't he? I know, Jacob, you sort of think that 98 Argentina performance is one of England's best.
Yeah, I think that there were a lot of promising signs under Hoddle. If you strip away everything that happened leading to his sacking and beyond that as well, the comments that he did or didn't make in that interview, the team's form after 98 had kind of deteriorated, and they were in a pretty bad place in qualifying for Euro 2000 by the time he did get sacked. But there was obviously the performance away against Italy to get them to the World Cup in 1998, which was a brilliantly disciplined, tactical, defensive performance, and they almost ended up winning it at the end, where Ian Wright goes through and hits the post, and that was probably a stronger Italy side than the one they faced in at Wembley in 96, the Dutch side, and they have to go there and make sure that they get that draw against in Rome, I think it was, and they managed to do that without Shearer, who was injured after that summer. That's probably, you could hold that up as perhaps a better performance, and just evidence of the tactical awareness that Hoddle himself had. He was then able to bring in quite a few younger players into the side that that were probably just slightly too, it was probably slightly too soon for them, 96. So you're talking about Beckham, Scholes, Michael Owen obviously had just come onto the scene at Liverpool. You could make the argument that there was probably more talent at his disposal in 98. Would have been interesting to see what Venables might have done with it. But I do think that England were quite close in that tournament, and that performance against Argentina could have easily been, there's quite a few moments and quite a few what if moments where they could have easily beaten what was, again, a stronger Argentina side in 98 than the Holland side that they faced in 96.
Question from Jim here, saying, seeing David Platt come on as a sub in pretty much every game during Euro 96 and only being 15 at the time and not having ever seen him play, I wanted to ask, was he any good as a player? Simon?
So there was certainly a period watching England where it looked like David Platt was the only guy who might ever score for us. Maybe just after, in the period between Lineker and Shearer, he was our best goal threat. His timing, the timing of his runs from midfield into attack beyond the forward line, was superb. His finishing was excellent. He wasn't the dynamic. So he comes on for Paul Ince in this match, and he is not a Paul Ince, but I think he's always been underestimated as a player, and I think he was really important for England.
Tay says, how the hell was that not a penalty on Steve Stone? I don't know what game he's watching, but he says, special mention for the fact that Steve Stone was only 25. What a paper round he had. We watched the old ITV coverage. It was lovely to see Bob Wilson, Barry, who is one, I mean, I know it's sort of commonly said one of the nicest men in football, but genuinely one of the nicest men in football, with Jack Charlton and John Barnes. John Barnes in a beautiful cream jacket.
Both my grandfathers passed away before I was born, so I don't know what it's like to have a granddad. But if I could choose one, I think I would probably choose Bob Wilson, because he's... I have met him, but I've spoken to him sort of on the phone doing radio stuff with you and a couple of other things, and he is one of the nicest people I have ever not really met. So yeah, if I could hand pick a granddad, I'd probably go for Bob. And obviously he's had his own tribulations and set up the Willow Foundation and raises a lot of money for charity. He's just a absolutely top bloke, so pleasure to see him on the air. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, just while we're talking about stuff off the pitch, Glenn Tilbrook from Squeeze sung the national anthem before the match, and I was just wondering when it was decided that we had to have an opera singer sing our national anthem. And Squeeze neither here nor there, but I'm not so keen on these opera singers, and think that they had it closer to right back in 96.
Yeah, what you mean, the sort of, you don't like the warbly bit of the anthem, you know, when they go they change tone and go up an octave.
Well, so it's not like a competition, a singing competition. It's leading a rabble in a chorus, and I think that a more ordinary guy character is better at that particular job.
But it's the before the semi final against Germany. I think whoever's going to sing it, the English national anthem, he's about to get going, and the crowd just get going instead of him, and he just steps aside.
I think generally. That it is communal singing that made this tournament, not football. That Three Lions in particular, that song, I think that there was a joy of hope, but also of, I don't know, I mean, it sounds ridiculous, but I do think the whole stadium singing a song together is very uniting. A whole country singing a song together is a very strong unifying force. And it was there for us in that year, and it hasn't really been. So now England matches, there's a brass band who decide what you sing, and mainly what you sing is God Save the Queen or the Dam Busters theme. And we just, that has been taken away from us. And I think that that is something that really made Euro 96 special.
I would agree with Simon there, because as a Republic of Ireland fan, we haven't really had any proper anthems. You know, we tend to veer more towards novelty songs that aren't particularly good. And I'm always jealous of England with their songs. You know, World in Motion springs to mind, Three Lines as well, ones that really captured the public imagination in a way that I think the Republic of Ireland haven't had. I may well be leaving one out, blindingly obvious one out, but I don't think I am. I'm pretty sure I'm not.
Jacob, how would you review Euro 96 as a tournament? Because in my mind, it's the greatest of all time, but I haven't watched every game. In fact, that's the only game I've watched back in the last 25 years.
I think that for English fans, it was incredible because of, for all the reasons we've just spoken about. Most of their games were extremely dramatic, probably apart from the first game against Switzerland. And it ends on an incredibly low note, but a moment that nobody would ever forget, with the Southgate penalty miss. But a lot of the games themselves away from that were quite boring. You could mention the Holland-France quarterfinal, 0-0, went to penalties. I think it was dreadful. I think anybody who would watch that on when ITV show it, I think would realise quite how bad some of those games were. Simon was saying before, the France-Czech Republic semi-final was maybe one of the worst games he's ever been to. That was 0-0, went to penalties. The final was quite good. The first ever golden goal from Bierhoff, but even that was an absolute howler from the goalkeeper. There weren't too many great teams in it as well. I think Italy went out in the first round. Holland, as we've said, were not the team that they probably were showing in 98, with Kluivert not fit, David's gone, Overmars injured. I think Spain obviously were not the Spain that we've come to see in the last 10 years or so. So yeah, probably a little bit overrated and coloured by the fact that it was so incredible for English fans.
Because this was the time of sort of lad culture was at its peak. Loaded magazine, Badil and Skinner, Three Lines, Booze and, you know, Oasis and Blur and whatnot. But a kind of myth has built up around this tournament, because apart from the England games and the Scotland games, a lot of the matches weren't particularly well attended, and it didn't really capture the public imagination insofar as everyone was into it, watching it on TV or going to the England games. But teams involving other countries didn't attract a huge amount of support, and a lot of the grounds were half empty, which seems surprising.
I remember a couple of weeks before the tournament started, I decided I really should probably be going to a game, and I phoned up the ticket hotline, and I asked for a couple of games, bought tickets for those, and then I was on the spur of the moment, I said, I don't suppose you've got one for a semi-final, and they said, well, which semi-final would you like? Now, this is 2 weeks before the European Championship in England, and you could literally take your pick of which semi-final you wanted to buy a ticket for. You're absolutely right that people didn't, and until the bandwagon got rolling, people weren't sure they wanted to be on it.
I think there were, though, I guess, in its defence, there were some iconic moments, and you've got, for a start, the emergence of that really cracking Czech Republic side, for which was so entertaining for between 96 and Euro 2004, a tournament that they probably should have won, with, you know, Patrick Berger, Smica, Pavel Nedved was obviously an incredible player. And then you've got Poborski's weird chip, which won them the quarterfinal against Portugal. And the other chip would be Davor Suker against against Denmark in the group stage.
Oh yeah,
where he embarrasses Peter Schmeichel. Again, another really good unfashionable team that kind of broke through around that in that tournament as well. And they had a good game as well. The quarterfinals against Germany. I think they might have gone 1-0 up, or it was 1-1 at Old Trafford. That was maybe one of the better games in the knockout stages. So there were some decent moments here and there.
And Barry, I mean, just finally, I know you enjoyed watching me watch England lose to Croatia in Russia 2018. But if you'd seen my face when 17-year-old Max watched the montage that the BBC did with Walk Away by Cast as they replayed Southgate missing that penalty, you'd have been a delighted 23-year-old Irishman, I can tell you.
Oh, fair enough. Look, I know I'm sounding like the Grinch here, but somebody has to put up the counter view.
And it's a role you do very well, Barry.
I've been nothing if not consistent in my views. I would have wanted England to lose this game, but as I said, it was a happy time in my life, so I would have taken it on the chin.
All right, that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll speak to Archie in Germany, round up what's happening with Project Restart, and we'll begin with Sid in Spain. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Before we do Project Restart in England, let's talk to Sid Lowe in Spain. Sid, how are you doing?
I'm all right, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, tremendous. Thanks very much. So Spain's Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, has given the green light for football to return in the week beginning the 8th of June. What's the reaction been to that?
I think the reaction more than anything else has been, obviously, everybody's pretty happy, or almost everybody is pretty happy with this. I think there was a sense that, particularly from the league's point of view, that this allows them to hit the target they were aiming for, which was the 12th of June. They knew that to get to the 12th of June, they would need the government's de-escalation protocol to have reached phase three by the 8th, which is the date that Pedro Sanchez is talking about. So I think there's a degree of relief, there's a degree of happiness. I think even those people who are uneasy about this, even those people who think, you know, with quite a lot of justification, that football's not the same without fans and in front of empty stadiums, it won't quite feel right. But I still think the immense majority of people are pretty pleased about this. The other thing that's worth pointing out as well is that Pedro Sanchez made a point of saying that while football is very important in terms of, you know, how people feel and also the economics of it and how many people follow it both inside Spain and outside Spain, he made a point of saying, but this is not the only activity we will start to get back. You know, we'll start to get back, and I think he explicitly mentioned cinema, theatre, there was another one which I can't for the life of me remember, and of course the big one that everyone's talking about, much more so all the way through this process, much more so even than football, is the return of terraces, so you can go and have a drink.
That is, God, the time that we'll be able to do that. Although a lot of pubs I've seen are doing takeaway and then there's lots of people sitting on the floor outside the pub right now in this kind of weird lockdown isn't quite finished. You mentioned cinemas and theatres. Now, I mean, clearly they're not going to be behind closed doors. Is there any implication that football won't be behind closed doors as well?
No, none at all. Tebas, in a meeting, well, a video meeting with the presidents of the league, told them around about... Oof, you know, time slips by and I'm not exactly sure when. I think it's about 3 weeks ago, told presidents of the league not to expect to be playing in front of fans until probably next year, so early 2021. That's no more than a guess, obviously, at this stage, but there's no suggestion at all that any of the 11 weeks worth of games remaining this season will be played with fans. As you say, in terms of the parallel with cinemas and theatres and so on, it was suggested to Tebas at one point that football was getting kind of preferential treatment. And he said, well, no, it's not necessarily preferential treatment, even though we're trying to move things quickly to get back. He said, because bear in mind that we focus in two dimensions. One is the, if you like, the performance in front of the crowd, and the other is the performance in front of TV cameras. And he said, so we're not being accelerated ahead of theatres or cinemas. We're being allowed to do the part, one half of what we do, you know, which is the half that goes on TV screens. But in terms of actually playing in front of an audience, there is no anticipation at all that will come back. And I think probably what we'll see is that this will be a case of finishing this season, and then maybe they'll discuss what happens for the new season, which we don't know when it will start. You know, my guess is it will be sometime in October. And maybe at that point, there'll be some attempt perhaps to bring in a certain number of fans with some social distancing. But there is no plans at all to do so at the moment.
Could I just interject rather pointlessly to point out that I'm finding it very difficult to concentrate on anything Sid says because of my computer screen in front of me. He's sitting on Zoom in front of a backdrop of a glorious sunset behind a football stadium. I'm going to guess is Real Oviedo. And then directly above him, Simon is in his duvet fort. His duvet fort or soundproofing. So, yeah, it's quite the comical vista I'm looking at.
That is one of the things about lockdown, isn't it? It brings everyone into bizarre scenarios all the time and brings a lot of people into a lot of houses and seeing things that they probably shouldn't see at times. I assume you saw the Carlo Ancelotti one the other day, that his dog starts barking, much as Estella does here, and Carlo Ancelotti's wife is on all fours creeping into the kitchen behind to try and get the dog out. Unfortunately, she's not creeping quite low enough to be out of shot.
Sid, it's been a long time since I looked at the La Liga table. I'd completely forgotten there's actually a title race going on when this eventually does start again.
Yeah, someone actually said this to me about 20 minutes ago, talking to a friend here in Spain. They sort of said, you know, about the English league going back and, of course, the fact that there's this battle over whether or not there should be relegation. And you sort of say, well, if there's no relegation, there's no title race to be played out really in England, because obviously Liverpool, barring some absolute miracle, are going to win the league. But in Spain, yeah, it's very, very open. The three at the bottom are definitely favourites to go down, because the gap is big-ish, but it's not so big that any of the three are gone. As you say, at the top, there's a real title race, because Madrid and Barcelona are 2 points apart. Barcelona top, Real Madrid second. And there's a really big race as well for third, because Atletico Madrid, Real Sociedad, Sevilla, Getafe, all of them will feel like they've got a chance for third place. So yeah, it's going to be 11 weeks of everything still in play.
And what's happening with the Copa del Rey and with the lower leagues in Spain?
Well, the Copa del Rey is a very different case, and I think it probably is worth highlighting. The Copa del Rey is different, first of all, because all of the games have been played except for the final. In fact, the final was supposed to be played on, I think it was the 18th of April. So the final should have been and gone by now. The final is between Real Sociedad and Athletic Bilbao, a Basque derby, the first time they've ever met each other in a final. And both clubs took the decision, which I must admit I really like. Whether or not it's practical is another issue, but I really like it in terms of what it signifies. They took the decision that they wanted to play this final in front of fans, however long it took. So if that means waiting till October, to December, to next year, they want to play in front of fans. And there was a moment, for example, when UEFA was suggesting to the Spanish League that they needed to the Spanish Federation, that they needed to hurry this along because, of course, they need to choose European positions for next year. And Athletic Bilbao and Real Sociedad both took the decision that even if this means potentially forfeiting a European place, we still want to wait for our fans. Now, I don't know if that will ultimately play out like that, if that will ultimately be allowed. But at the moment, at least, there is no date for the Copa del Rey and no hurry even to set one.
And lower leagues below La Liga?
So the lower leagues, the first division and the second division are coming back together. The first division and second division are the jurisdiction of La Liga. From the second division B, which is the third tier, although it's split across four regional groups and there's 80-odd teams in it, and the third division, which, as I say, would then therefore be anything from, you know, the fourth to the 15th tier, a whole load of teams, 360 in total, I think, across 18 groups. Those are theoretically amateur in terms of the way that they're discussed in Spain, and they belong to the federation, not the league. Now, they're not amateur at all, and the second division B in particular, they're very definitely professional, but those leagues have been abandoned now. The only thing that's still open in both Segunda B and in Tercera, second division B and third division, is the playoffs, which we think will be played sometime in the back end of June or early July, and that will decide promotions. But there are going to be no relegations, which, of course, you can probably imagine, creates a massive mess logistically, because you've got a whole load of teams will be able to go up, but no one's going to go down. And so that has actually forced the Spanish Federation into creating a whole new division at Segunda B level. So where at the moment Segunda B is four groups, it will be five next year. So it's a bit of a mess.
And just finally, Sid, do you want to go back to games, cover games in the stadium?
Yes, definitely I do. And yet, I must admit, I'm not sure if I feel totally happy about it. Not so much that I feel unhappy now, as I must admit, I don't know how I will feel when it happens. You know, so at the moment, of course, look, we've had no football for, what is it, 8 weeks or whatever. I want Spanish football to come back. And of course, I'm entirely biased because we're people who, you know, who our living depends on this as well. You know, this is what we do for a job as well as being something we like. I want to be able to sit in my living room and watch a load of football. I will feel a bit weird watching it in front of empty stadiums, I think, but I suspect that will wear off quite quickly. But I also think I will feel a bit weird just about the whole thing. And I think while it's a kind of an intangible question, one that doesn't have a proper answer, I think this is, broadly speaking, a question that's going around a lot of people's minds, which is, what will this be like for us? I mean, will we feel okay? Will we enjoy this, or will we actually feel like something is horribly missing? But look, I'm not going to lie. Much as I want the fans there, much as I think like this, I feel like this doesn't really matter. Much as I feel like it sort of feels a bit weird, maybe even slightly grubby. The truth is, yeah, I want the football back. Of course I do.
Lovely to speak to you, Sid. Lovely to see you. And Real Oviedo behind you. And take care.
It is a Real Oviedo game, but it's not actually their stadium. I should probably admit that at this point. It's Rayo Vallecano Stadium.
I thought it was. I just didn't want to say. nice to see you, Sid. Take care.
Cheerio. Bye.
Sid Lowe there. Thanks, Sid, out in Spain. From Spain, let's go to Cologne, where Archie Rintutt is standing by after some more Bundesliga action. Archie, how are you?
Very well, Max. Yourself?
Yeah, I'm all right. Thanks very much. So I watched Bayern beat Eintracht Frankfurt, and for about 2 minutes, when Bayern were 3-0 up and Frankfurt brought it back to 3-2, it looked like a very unlikely comeback.
Yeah, because Bayern were in control for the entirety of the first half, and when they scored within a minute of the restart, you thought, well, this is done. And I think Bayern's players did as well. But then Frankfurt's cult hero, an Austrian defender called Martin Hinteregger, who I would describe him as a no-nonsense defender who has been very dangerous at set pieces this season. He scored twice, and then he completed his hat-trick. However, that was for Bayern's fifth, with a rather unfortunate but quite funny own goal that he scored. But yeah, he's a cult hero with Eintracht Frankfurt. I've actually got a T-shirt with his name on it, which is called the Hinty Army. The Eintracht Frankfurt fans made a video riffing off status quo's "We're in the army now" to "We're Hinty Army now." So it kind of only grew his cult appeal. But yeah, when it comes to the Bundesliga title race, Bayern still looking incredibly strong, and I would say going into this game now against Borussia Dortmund, 4 points clear, still in very good shape under Hansi Flick. And yeah, apart from those two set pieces, Frankfurt did have some more chances to score, but there was no point really where you thought that Bayern weren't going to outscore them.
So it's good in a way, isn't it, that there've been at least two games before the Bayern Dortmund game on Tuesday, and Dortmund had another straightforward win as well.
Straightforward, yes, in a sense, but Wolfsburg had a very good chance to equalise and hit the bar at 1-0. But in previous years, you would have said that this was the kind of situation which Dortmund would have found a way to not win the game. And actually, in the second half of the season now, they've won 9 of their 10 games, something of an Erling Haaland effect, even if he didn't even have a shot on Saturday, albeit for the first goal he missed his kick, which actually allowed the ball to go through to Rafael Guerrero. But Dortmund are looking quietly good. I think that they enjoy this underdog role a little bit more than leading the title race as they did last season. Remember, they were 9 points out in front at one point before Bayern Munich came back and inevitably won it. But going into this game on Tuesday, it's going to be really interesting to see how Bayern handle Erling Haaland. Mats Hummels is a doubt. He came off at half-time of this game for Dortmund. However, Jerome Boateng also came off with an injury, but it's been cleared up that he can play. Thiago, though, is looking a real doubt for Bayern.
And what are the other headlines for you from the weekend? And has anyone, I'm sort of interested in, you know, when the Premier League comes back, if a team will be significantly better or worse than they were 2 months ago, or is it pretty much played to form?
I mean, Schalke have been as bad as they were in 2020 before the lockdown. Things seem to have only got worse for them. They lost 4-0 at Dortmund last week, of course, and then getting thumped 3-0 by Augsburg today. Very bad result for David Wagner, who's, yeah, I think maybe he didn't quite appreciate the mammoth tasks that he was taking on at Schalke. The other important results, Leverkusen winning 3-1 at Gladbach is a big result in terms of the Champions League standings, as was RB Leipzig winning 5-0 away at Mainz. They beat Mainz 8-0 earlier in the season, so that's an aggregate win of 13-0 over the season, and Timo Werner scored hat-tricks in both of those. So that means that Gladbach now drop out of the top four. And yeah, I mean, you might say that you could have a three or four-way title race if Dortmund beat Bayern on Tuesday. And then just to mention as well at the bottom, Werder Bremen got a big win away at Freiburg. That pushes them to within 3 points of Uwe Rösler's Fortuna Düsseldorf, who somehow, after leading 2-0 away at Cologne in the Rhein derby, managed to throw that lead away. And should also say in the Berlin derby, Hertha beat Union 4-0 on Friday night.
Archie, I noticed there was only two home wins across the 3 days of fixtures. Does mm-hmm. that suggest that playing behind closed doors renders home advantage pretty much insignificant?
I'm not sure, because if you look back through the weekends before the lockdown had begun, you look at three home wins across the weekend, three home wins, three, two, another three, and four. And you have to go back to January until you find a weekend where you had six home wins. So I think it more speaks to just how competitive that the league is right now. And I think it's a good thing. But yeah, there's a lot said for how some teams can and can't cope without their fans. But I think you've seen a lot of away wins as it is in the Bundesliga this season, so it's difficult to say that teams are suffering that much more right now. So yeah,
did you have that information in front of you on a screen, or are you like Johnny Five from Short Circuit with an ability to recall facts?
I couldn't possibly reveal that, Max.
Oh, that's fair enough. I mean, there are many things you don't like to reveal about your life on this pod anymore. Listen, thanks, Archie. We'll speak to you again soon.
Cheers, Max. Thanks.
Archie Rintut there out in Germany. Now, Project Restart in England. An unnamed Bournemouth player is one of two new coronavirus cases discovered by the latest round of Premier League tests, taking the overall total of positive results to 8. The club won't reveal the player's identity, but that player will now self-isolate for 7 days. The other positive was at a different club, which has not been named. Tests took place on Tuesday, Thursday and Friday of last week with 996 players and club staff tested. In the Championship, two individuals from the same club have tested positive after 1,014 tests were undertaken at all 24 Championship sides over the past 72 hours. Speaking on Friday, Premier League Chief Executive Richard Masters said the league was, quote, as confident as we can be about restarting in June. The guidance for the second phase of training, which would allow contact, is waiting to be signed off by the government, who have nothing better to do at the moment. The Premier League is due to meet on Wednesday and Thursday for further discussions about restarting the season, with the results of the third round of testing also due later in the week. Simon, you're a Watford fan, kind of at the centre of the COVID-19 Premier League return. I just wonder what your take on all of it is.
Well, as Watford fans, it's been a bit uncomfortable that the whole kind of wave after wave of Watford stories, which appeared concerted enough for people to suggest that it was part of an organised campaign on the club to knock down the idea of restarting, which I'm convinced it wasn't. But there were strong articles written or interviews given by the club's chairman, the club's captain and the club's manager, all quite outspoken. After all that, what I think the club didn't need was to have three people test positive in that first round of tests, which was starting to make it look like people were literally injecting themselves with deadly viruses just to protect the club's Premier League status. I'm convinced that we happen to have a captain who is very confident in his opinions and has a strong voice, and the club does not discourage him from speaking when he feels like he wants to, and the same with the manager. And that what Deeney has done is he has given players the license to go with their conscience in either direction. And I think that not every player and not every club has that. And so a few other players have also not joined in training and would be uncomfortable about, and some of the players who have gone in this phase one would be uncomfortable about a move to contact training. So it is awkward. I really seriously wish, you know, there were so many games this season that Watford stuffed up from positions where they should have won. And if Watford were just 6 or 6 points better off, this would all look a little less desperate. I genuinely don't believe that it comes, that it's motivated by self-interest, but I do see that that has been the impression that lots of people have taken.
I'm surprised to hear you say that, Simon, actually, because it's not the impression I've got, and I was unaware that it seems to be an impression many others have got, and I tend to read a lot of papers and stay across what's going on. So are you perhaps being a little bit paranoid?
Well, I mean, possibly. The fact is that we are Watford are fourth bottom of the league, and you know, coincidentally, you also have Hull City in the Championship, who are being quite outspoken in their belief that division shouldn't be restarted, and they're also fourth bottom of that league. It is about optics more than anything else. And I do think that some fans of other clubs do think that this is a desperate attempt to grab survival by means fair or foul.
In fact, Christian Cavasselli replied to one on Twitter today, didn't he, saying, "Let me explain our tactic. We are doing one injection of COVID-19 once a week. We draw the player, member of staff, who gets it like this. We're sure we'll never play again and avoid relegation," with one of those hands on the head emojis. But I'd recommend, he's quite a fun follow, actually, Cavasselli. West Ham on the same number of points, Jacob. Karen Brady, didn't she write earlier in the lockdown that the season needed to be voided, and then changed her opinion? I've forgotten.
Yeah, she did. She did write that at the start of the lockdown, that it may come to that. And sorry, Liverpool fans, it may well come to this. But obviously, there's not going to be no relegation. That's pretty clear. That it may happen in League Two, although there's a dispute coming over that, whether or not the EFL are going to sanction that. But in the Premier League, I think it's pretty clear that there will be three teams going down. If the season doesn't start, then you get into the points per game situation. And obviously there are two different scenarios in that case. One doesn't, it keeps the current bottom three going down. The other one puts West Ham, who are 16th, into the bottom three, keeps Bournemouth up, sends West Ham down by 0.17 of a point. So in that situation, given what they know now, I think they've suddenly thought might be better to play. I think that West Ham have shown before the lockdown that they're probably good enough to stay up. It'd probably just be better that they play and get the points on the board, avoid any possibility that they could go down in that situation. As Simon was saying before, that there might be some teams who are more willing to give their players the freedom to not to train if they want to. The other flip side of that is that you've got Chelsea higher up in the league, who obviously have let N'Golo Kante skip training, and it may well be that he just won't play. There will be that situation probably coming up once the contact training starts and more players potentially decide that they're not willing to take that risk. And it's quite hard to see if, for example, Kante holds that view at the moment, what would make him change his mind. So potentially you've got Chelsea not having a really important player. Similarly with Watford, you've got potentially Troy Deeney. It's hard to see what would make him change his mind if this is the view that he honestly holds. Obviously, he's got his son who has breathing difficulties. And for Watford's perspective, they're potentially going into those final nine games without the guy who scores all their goals.
I would say that there is a bit of a vacuum of knowledge with the status of the virus in Britain at the moment, and that if there was enough community testing being done for players to know the genuine prevalence of the virus in their areas and the number of people who are developing symptoms, if that was genuinely low, and if there was confidence that people who do develop symptoms are being dealt with a decent system of contact tracing, then that gives confidence to everyone in all sectors of society, including footballers. And I feel that that's what we need to unlock further, and that would allow us to then play football.
So I think that football itself is going to be, is with testing in place for football, everything is going to be very clean when they go in there. There's obviously going to be extreme social distancing once you're in and around the stadiums and everything. But as you saw with Mariappa, he was asymptomatic. he doesn't know, he has been isolating, he said in that interview in the Telegraph, he doesn't know how he got it. So clearly someone could bring it into the stadium in between those tests, for example. And obviously it's going to be potentially another player who does get infected, and who knows what could happen.
Obviously, we will update you on Thursday and as the weeks progress with Project Restart. Barry, do you want an update on the sex dolls in South Korea?
Absolutely, yes.
Excellent. Anyway, so yes, finally on the pod, you'll remember that FC Seoul accidentally put some sex dolls in the stand. Or we had quite a philosophical debate about at what point a sex doll becomes a sex doll. If it's not working, then clearly it's just a doll. Anyway, they've been fined a record 1 million Korean won, which is $82,000, for, quote, damaging the prestige and integrity of the league after using sex dolls instead of mannequins to fill empty seats during their K-League match. They placed around 20 dolls, some of which were dressed in the team's colours, while others held placards supporting the side in the stands on last Sunday to make up for the absence of fans. Do you think justified or unjustified? Simon, you're under your duvet, your hand is raised.
Just a point of information. I think the fine, you said it was 1 million won. I think it was 100 million. So that's the most interesting bit of the story. Like, that's 100 million won. I mean, that is a big number of won to only be $81,000. That's incredible.
This is exchange rate chat. There's no better way to end the podcast.
You know when to stop recording is when we when we reach that stage.
Exactly. And that'll do then for today's pod. Mark had asked the question, how long could you go on a car journey without stopping for a wee? Barry, you can finish that one if you like. It's 250 miles. Do you reckon you could do it?
Yeah, I probably could. I think I'd need to stop and stretch my legs, though, at some point.
Right, that'll do. Jacob, thanks so much for coming on. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Cheers, Simon.
Pleasure.
Thank you, Barry.
You're very welcome.
And we'll be back on Thursday. And before that, tomorrow, we will release an extra special, the final chapter of Detective Wilson.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.